From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. A big blow to the Trump administration today from the Supreme Court, which ruled that the question, are you a citizen, can't, for now, be added to the census. And the court cited concerns about the administration's justification for the question. They also decided not to decide partisan gerrymandering because it isn't in their job description or words to that effect. Let's bring in Dahlia Lithwick. She writes about the courts and law for Slate. She hosts the podcast Amicus. Dahlia, start with the census question. This was a complicated ruling, but can you give us a thumbnail of that decision?
Sure, Robin. Essentially, what happened is that Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross decided that they wanted to put a citizenship question onto the census for the first time since 1950. There was a pretty broad consensus that that would depress all sorts of minority voting and the voting of unrepresented folks. But Ross insisted that this was needed, that the Justice Department had asked for it in order to enforce the Voting Rights Act. Whole bunch of evidence was brought by challengers suggesting that's not quite the way the question got onto the census, and that in fact he had asked the Justice Department to do this, not to enforce the Voting Rights Act. And so really the big question was for the court how this decision was taken and whether it was taken appropriately.
Yeah. And they have those words, you know, for now, you know, they've decided for now. So what happens now? Because you mentioned that evidence, some of it was, you know, documents found on the computer of a deceased Republican strategist, clearly outlining his position that this question would benefit Republicans and other whites. And so this, of course, was something that people were hoping the courts would look at. Do we know if the Supreme Court did? And does this mean that a lower court might get this again and they might have that material? I mean, what happens?
Well, that all that material came about later, and this was not about the implications for race. This was not the equal protection part of the case. So we're going to have lower courts that are going to look at all that new evidence that this was done for racial reasons to suppress minority votes. What we do know is that Robert sides with the liberals to say, I don't like this pretextual, you know, rationale. He kicks it back. So certainly they are giving the Trump administration the opportunity to do it again without the lying. And I think that that's what we're going to see happen, whether they can get that done in time. They had said they absolutely need to do this by July in order to get it printed on the census. So now the question is going to be whether they say, you know what, if you give us another bite at the apple, we could still get it done by October.
But that's astonishing what you just said. Do it again without the lying. So we'll see. We also got that 5-4 decision today on partisan gerrymandering. Now, this is carving up voting districts for political gain. This isn't something that the courts have already ruled on, which is carving up districts on racial with racial boundaries and that would hurt minorities. The court has already ruled you can't do that. But this is political gain. Two cases, one challenging maps made by Republican lawmakers in North Carolina, another challenging maps drawn by Democrats in Maryland. The majority ruling, this isn't an issue for federal courts. Why not?
Well, this is a case I feel like if I had a dollar for every time we've even talked about these political gerrymandering cases on this show, Robin,
right.
I would be a wealthy woman. So this has gone back and forth to the Supreme Court, always with the hopes that a political gerrymander could be found unconstitutional if the court could find what was called a justiciable standard, some test whereby the court could say, all right, here we have in North Carolina, we've got lines that were drawn that somehow in a state that's essentially 50-50 Democrat-Republican. Republicans make up 10% of the congressional delegation and 3 are Democrats. What could we do that would be a test to find when it's gone too far? And as you say, today, Chief Justice John Roberts, writing on behalf of the court's conservative wing 5-4, says, you know what? We're never going to find a test. It's not our purview. It's not appropriate. Essentially drops the mic and says, justices are out of this.
A mic drop by the Chief Justice. But where do you go? He said, this doesn't mean if you have a challenge, I want you to fall in some sort of void. So where is it supposed to be fixed?
Well, I think what he says is, look, there's a whole bunch of fixes that don't involve judicial power. So, for instance, we could have Congress do a fix. We have states that are doing a fix. He cites state initiative citizenship initiatives to fix redistricting in a nonpartisan way, something, by the way, he had declared unconstitutional a few years earlier. So he lays out, he says, look, state Supreme Courts all around are finding unconstitutional political gerrymander. So you all go ahead and do it without us. Elena Kagan, in a very pointed dissent, says, if state courts can do this, why can't we?
Yeah. And in fact, she said the decision was tragic. Dahlia Lithwick, host of the podcast Amicus, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
You know, Robin, it was a year ago right now, right at the end of the Supreme Court term, that Anthony Kennedy decided that he was retiring. And you can already see the difference that that is making in these decisions. Now with another conservative on the court. Well, 10 more Democratic presidential candidates, including frontrunner Joe Biden, will be on stage in Miami to debate each other tonight. Last night, the first group of 10 debated and appeared to be sharply divided on immigration, health care, and other issues. NPR senior editor and Washington correspondent Ron Elving joins us now. Hi, Ron.
Hi there, Jeremy.
So Elizabeth Warren was front and center last night. She was polling best out of the contenders that were on the stage last night, and she's been a leader on many progressive policies. NBC anchor Lester Holt asked the candidates to raise their hands if they wanted to abolish private health insurance in favor of a government-run plan, and only Warren and New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio raised their hands. Here's Warren.
There are a lot of politicians who say, oh, it's just not possible. We just can't do it. It's have a lot of political reasons for this. What they're really telling you is they just won't fight for it. Well, health care is a basic human right, and I will fight for basic human rights.
So an applause line there. But, Ron, many Americans would balk at getting rid of their private health insurance. Even Democrats would balk at that. How much traction does this idea have among Democrats?
It is gaining traction among some Democrats and progressive independents, Jeremy. But as you saw last night, most of the candidates weren't there yet. And of course, Republicans are going to call it socialized medicine. Insurance companies are going to call it the death of their health policy portfolios. So they're all going to fight it. Just as Elizabeth Warren said, this is going to be a fight. And most Americans, as you suggest, still rely on some form of private insurance through their employers. But satisfaction with that arrangement is eroding steadily and drastically in some cases. And Elizabeth Warren may just be ahead of her time.
Let's talk about immigration. The debate was simulcast on all the NBC channels, including Telemundo. Three candidates on the stage used Spanish intermittently, including Beto O'Rourke and Julian Castro. Here they are speaking in English, but they're talking about immigration. Castro criticized O'Rourke, who said he supports decriminalizing asylum seekers. Castro said he'd strike down part of the immigration code that criminalizes people who enter the country illegally.
I'm talking about a comprehensive rewrite of our immigration
laws.
That's not true. And if we do that, I don't think it's asking too much for people to follow our laws when they come to this
country. I'm talking about millions
of
folks. A lot of folks that are coming are not seeking asylum. A lot of them are undocumented immigrants.
So here we are with Castro saying something that we haven't heard from other candidates, which is that he wants to decriminalize anybody who comes into the country illegally.
You know, thus far in the campaign, immigration's been mostly a source of ammunition against President Trump on the part of the Democrats. But there are some differences among them, as you note, and Julian Castro is differentiating himself with this. Now, he was talking about a particular section of the law, referring to it by its number. And when you do that, when you argue about specific sections by number, you are generally leaving most of the audience behind. But what he is essentially saying is, let's not see immigration as a crime. Let's see immigration as something our country needs, and let's welcome these people, and let's come up with a different model for how to regulate it.
It seems like Castro and Cory Booker, the senator, got a lot more visibility than they have so far in the campaign last night. What do you think this debate meant for them?
I think it was a lifeblood transfusion for both of them, especially Booker, who at one time had hoped to be among the top five and has been mostly second tier in the polling so far. Ditto for Castro, really. He's had very little attention, and it's hard to maintain any kind of profile as a former cabinet member and mayor, even though he is, after all, the leading Hispanic in the field.
Ron, it was interesting that the candidates did not mention President Trump that much last night.
Nope. And I suspect that will change tonight. Joe Biden clearly wants to run against Trump and not against his Democratic rivals. The same would have to go for Bernie Sanders, although he also wants to beard Biden as the front runner on the Democratic side. Bernie, after all, is an independent, and so he can go after the front runner in both parties, even as he runs for the Democratic nomination. Last night, you had a lot of unknowns and little knowns who wanted to introduce themselves to the American people. Tonight, you've got a few more of those, but you also have a handful who are much better known, polling well, and are ready to project themselves into a fall campaign against Trump.
Not just Biden and Sanders, but also Buttigieg and Harris will be on the stage tonight.
That's right. I think most people are going to be paying attention to the clash between Biden and Bernie. And my guess is Joe Biden might want to use his sense of humor as a positive contrast with Bernie Sanders. Not that Biden's going to do stand-up comedy, but that he will try to come across with a smile more often than, say, the senator from Vermont.
All right. Interesting to watch tonight. The one thing that threw me off last night was how many moderators there were. You'd think with 10 candidates, you wouldn't need, you know, four or five moderators, but we'll see. NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Here and Now is supported by Daily Harvest. Daily Harvest delivers carefully sourced, chef-crafted smoothies, soups, harvest bowls, overnight oats, and more, all built on fruits and vegetables. Each single-serving cup can be prepared in minutes. Daily Harvest is designed for convenience, so you can load up on fruits and vegetables first thing in the morning, before bed, and any time in between. Learn more about Daily Harvest and get three free cups in your first box when you go to dailyharvest.com and use promo code NOW. That's dailyharvest.com. Use promo code NOW.
50 years ago tomorrow, a police raid on a gay bar in New York City called the Stonewall Inn led to riots that are seen as the start of the LGBTQ rights movement. At the 10th anniversary in 1979, there was a gay pride parade in Greenwich Village featuring veterans of the riots and other demonstrators. Well, this Sunday, millions are expected at the World Pride March in New York, which has special significance coming on the weekend of the 50th anniversary of Stonewall. Joining us now are two people who were there 50 years ago and are now together, Paul Glass and Charles Evans of Falmouth, Massachusetts. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you.
Well, and first of all, you were both at Stonewall separately, but didn't even know that you were both there until recently. Explain that.
I was living in Boston at the time, still living at home, teenager, and I was exploring in New York for the weekend. And what I mean by exploring is that I wanted to see more of what the gay life had to offer in Greenwich Village. And Charles and I had met the year prior. We dated a little bit long distance, but then it appeared like it wasn't really going to work out, so I kind of sneaked in town without telling him. And I was on the other opposite end of Christopher Street down near the piers and was working my way back up towards Sheridan Square when folks were kind of running down the street and sending out word, almost like the town crier, that there was a commotion going on up in Sheridan Square. So everybody kind of ran in that direction. Charles was coming from a club on the opposite end of Christopher Street. So we never really saw one another.
And why had you not discussed before recently that you were both there at Stonewall at the same time?
I don't know. It just it never really came up. It wasn't something that I didn't think really to share it. I didn't realize it. You know, although I knew about what Stonewall kind of sparked a bit of a revolution, but it really didn't take hold or wasn't as publicized until now.
Mm-hmm. Charles, tell us a little bit about how you ended up there at Stonewall on that day. You were raised in North Carolina, but you were living in New York at the time.
Correct. I was raised down south by my aunt. So I was up visiting my parents for the summer. And as usual, you just hang out. And it was one of those days I wanted to go out, and I ended up going to the village. And there was this club called the Bonsoir that I would always frequent. And then it just happened to be that Friday after leaving the club, I came down West 4th Street. And as I approached West 4th Street, I saw a crowd. Now, going backwards a little bit, normally after we leave the club, we always go to Sheraton Square and just hang out. Just because young kids, I was, like I said, I was between summer, it was between my freshman and sophomore year in college. Mm-hmm. So we just wanted to hang out. And as we got close to Sheraton Square, we saw this crowd. And the next thing we knew, we were joining into the crowd. Now, as I've told others, it was kind of interesting because I was still in a riot mode because the month before, we had had a big riot at my college. And I guess so by getting into this crowd, it just made the adrenaline even higher. And the next thing I know, it's 50 years later, and here we are.
Well, and were you worried for your safety, Charles, that evening?
I didn't even think about that because when by the time we got there, I guess all the screaming and the hollering, then we kind of found out what was going on. So we kind of joined in. And it got to be the point, too, if you had lived in New York during that time or going to the clubs, you would be in the club and then all at once the music would stop. They would unplug the jukebox and the cops would come and they would walk around. So it got to be a point you were tired of being tired. So when we found out exactly what was going on, we felt good. So there was no danger. I felt no danger at all.
And what about you, Paul? Did you feel like you were in danger at all during Stonewall?
I didn't feel as much so much in danger because I felt we had numbers and it wasn't the kind of commotion, if you will, from the police. They were being resistant or pushing back, but they really weren't being as violent as I have seen them in other situations. I think they were more afraid of the crowd than the crowd was afraid of them. And they really were moving in reverse when they were being pelted with things that were being thrown at them. Mm-hmm. So I felt there was some safety from that perspective.
Paul, did it feel monumental or historic at the time?
It felt monumental, but I didn't feel the historic part until later.
And what about you, Charles? Did it feel monumental to you?
Yes, and too. I saw it in so many different ways. And being black and born in the South, this was just another time of fighting resistance. Mm-hmm. So it was just an uprising that I felt that was part of my nature to fight for my rights. So as talking about monumental, it was just another step forward for my rights. And this time not being as my racial rights, as my equality rights as being a gay person.
Well, and as you look back on it now, 50 years later, let me ask each of you, what impact do you think Stonewall had on gay rights in this country? I'll start with you, Charles.
It opened a lot of eyes. We just wasn't a group of people that were out in drags of being all girl and all the other stuff. We were humans also, and we had our rights. There were so many drag queens that were there that, you know, they would walk down the streets years later, or weeks later, should I say, and proud to say, here I am, accept me for who I am. And I didn't think, or I still don't think, that anyone has the right to tell us how we should live our life and how we should go out and enjoy ourselves.
And what about you, Paul?
Well, for me, it felt empowering. And I think it empowered all gays in general. It was one of the first times that the gays had fought back for and fought for their rights, felt as though they were no longer subhuman. You know, they felt that they should be respected and they had rights for a long time, certainly from my perspective, being the times that I had been out in gay life. The attitude was pretty much you didn't have any rights, so you just had to go along and comply with whatever was the order of the day. And folks began to feel as though when they come together, they had power. And that power was evident at Stonewall.
You're both gay and both African-American. As you look at all the progress that has been made for both of those groups over the decades, which do you feel at this point is the one that has more to be done, that there's more progress that needs to be made?
I would say both.
So would I. I think there's ground to be covered on both ends, on both fronts, both racially as well as for LGBTQ rights as well.
Do you think that a younger generation of LGBTQ people in this country understands what happened at Stonewall and how that led to where we are today?
No. And I look back when they were interviewing a young lady on at the Boston Pride, and they asked her, what was Stonewall all about? And she had the slightest idea. She even turned to her friends and said, could you help me out? So we are talking 50 years later, and it seemed like it was out of sight, out of mind to a lot of the young kids. And that's why I think it's so important for us older LGBTQ to try to communicate to these kids and let them understand the importance of it, because sometimes I think they just live for today.
There's a generation that has lost the rich history about Stonewall and a lot of the activism that happened post-Stonewall as well. There's a whole generation that just wasn't born around that time. So they're not in tune to all the rights that they have, that they enjoy now, that they are living on the backs of those who were part of that initial uprising and those who have carried the banner since then.
So as we approach the 50th anniversary of Stonewall, we should tell our listeners that even though you were on and off together over the years, you're now married, right? How did you finally decide to get together for good?
Well, it was that's a rich story, and I'll try to give the short version. I was living in New York. After 9/11, I left New York after 30 years and moved back to Massachusetts to Falmouth, where I had purchased a home. And it was not long after, it was a friend of mine who passed away, and a mutual friend came to the funeral. We were very close at the time, but he was still living in New York. We exchanged, and we hadn't been in communication. We exchanged information. The next weekend, he runs into Charles, and Charles and I at that point had a 12-year absence, and we hadn't been in communication, hadn't seen or spoken to one another. He gave Charles my number. He gave me Charles's number. I called him, and it looked like there was a little bit of a spark. I invited him to come to the Cape. He came, and it was on since then, and 2 years later, we got married.
Wow.
And that was 7 years ago.
7 years ago. Well, congratulations to both of you.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
That's Paul Glass and Charles Evans remembering Stonewall 50 years later. They were both there, and now they are married. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having us.
And according to the Stonewall Veterans Association, this was one of the songs on the jukebox in June 1969, Good Lovin' Ain't Easy to Come By, by Marvin Gaye and Tammy Terrell. You're listening to Here and Now.
Starting today, you have one more option for getting your orders from Amazon. Rite Aid drugstores. Amazon is launching this new pickup service at more than 100 Rite Aid stores today, with plans to expand service to all 1,500 by the end of the year. The latest demonstration of Amazon partnering with competitors, the traditional brick-and-mortar stores. What does it mean? Let's bring in Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Hi, Robin.
Hi, Robin Young.
So Amazon already has this huge distribution network devoted to delivering packages directly to your door. They have these Amazon centers popping up everywhere where you can return things. Why does it need these other options?
Because, alas, alack, agad, it can. I mean, Amazon is worth $940 billion. Amazon Prime, you know, the subscription business, it's on fire, and they just want to keep adding bells and whistles so they can keep hiking the annual fee to scare the likes of Walmart, Target, and Costco. And we also know that Amazon gets a special pass from Wall Street to do things like this and, you know, like shelling out $14 billion for Whole Foods. And it has its eye on potentially disrupting the prescription drug business and pharmacies.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. You know, is this a little bit of fox in the hen house? Because Rite Aid has had a tough go of it lately. Their stock price has dropped more than 80%. You might see a Rite Aid, you know, folding up, actually. Now has a market cap of less than $400 million. So is there a way that Rite Aid is thinking, well, maybe this could, you know, benefit us, more feet in the door? Or is Rite Aid going, oh, my gosh, you know, this guy's going to eat us, meaning Amazon?
I think Rite Aid's looking at it this way. You're getting Amazon customers in the door where they're more likely to buy something. And if they do this enough, they're going to start filling their prescriptions at Rite Aid. It's a case of, you know, the D student of drugstore chains that desperately needs foot traffic. And in one fell swoop, you bring in the biggest retailer in America.
Well, talk about, by the way, how Amazon works, because it has popped up that I can return things that I want to mail back by way of an Amazon center that's right near us instead of UPS or the post office or something. And it's completely free. How can they do that?
They're getting a pass from Wall Street. Amazon makes
a chunk
of change.
What do you mean by that? Yeah, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, Wall Street would measure a retailer from same store sales, the intensity of square footage, you know, what your labor ratio and these guys is. Wall Street is not necessarily looking at Amazon as a retailer per se. It's a web services company. It's a media giant. It's a bookseller. And so you can't even break out the Whole Foods numbers inside Amazon and say, did that $14 billion pay off for a company valued at $1 trillion? So it's kind of asymmetric warfare.
Okay. Well, back to this, these new drop-off services. Walmart, Target, Best Buy, they've been offering similar kind of services. Customers can order online, pick up items at a store. Are they taking away from Amazon?
Not so much taking away as kind of maybe staunching the decline of their own market share. And while they kind of have it figured out and they're saying, finally, we're catching up with Amazon, and that was the hope to begin the year, Amazon suddenly comes out with, you know, offering free same-day delivery and free one-day shipping on some Prime orders now in over 5,000 cities. So it's kind of like, you know, Wile E. Coyote and the Roadrunner.
Well, is it also Godzilla? Do you see Amazon buying Rite Aid outright?
Don't be surprised, especially considering that Amazon owns PillPack. That's looking to become one of the middlemen that's negotiating drug costs. CVS owns Caremark. Walgreens, which bought a ton of Rite Aids but left others on the curb, is also a middleman. And so Rite Aid's going to need Amazon as this foot in the door, and it can't go it alone. And if its financial outlook keeps worsening, you have a daddy Warbucks in Jeff Bezos, Amazon CEO. He's worth $130 billion.
Enough cultural references. Robin Farzad, thank you.
You love it. You love it. Thank you.
Facebook announced this month that it's launching its own cryptocurrency, the Libra, in 2020. It will be the latest in the hundreds of different currencies that have been used in the U.S. throughout its history. Yes, hundreds. For a look back at that, we're joined by historians Brian Ballow and Joanne Freeman, hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Jeremy. Good to be here.
So let's go back to the beginning, Joanne, to understand how we got to a place where we now have a currency named after a zodiac sign and based on a blockchain. Tell us about the earliest days of money in the United States.
Which definitely didn't have much to do with the zodiac sign, right?
Right.
Well, in the earliest years of the United States, there actually really wasn't a single uniform currency. So you had all kinds of currencies floating around at that point. You had private banks producing currency. You had people using foreign currency in the United States. And in 1792, the Coinage Act was really the first legislative attempt to create a mint and create some kind of a uniform national currency for the new nation. But that, even that, was still coins. So it was copper and silver and gold coins were what was being produced at that mint. Private banks, even when that happened, are still producing currency. In 1830, there were actually roughly 300 banks issuing their own currency. So there was a lot of complication between all of the different kinds of money floating around. And not surprisingly, one of the outcomes of that was it was very easy for counterfeiters to have a pretty hefty business going in this whole time period. And what counterfeiters knew, which I think it's easy to forget, is that as long as someone has confidence that the bill they're being handed is real, even if it's fake, that bill, at least for that moment, has value. So money is really about confidence in the bill that you're being given, and counterfeiters took full advantage of that.
And Brian, the currency was initially backed by both gold and silver. Later, the country just went with the gold standard. Why?
Well, that was called bimetallism, having a ratio between the value of gold currency and the value of silver currency. And that ratio was set at 10 to 1. And it seemed to work out pretty well until something called the gold rush happened. You may remember that, Jeremy. And because there was so much more gold that flooded the market, those currencies that were valued in gold really became very inflated. In other words, they weren't really worth as much compared to silver. Fortunately for the stability of gold, but not so good for debtors, the amount of gold in the world began to stabilize by the second half of the 19th century. And in fact, it was silver that was very available. It was very available in part because countries were not using it as much to back their currency.
Brian, not only do I remember the gold rush, I also was in a play when I was like 6 years old where one of the songs was, "There's gold in the mountains of California."
Do you want to sing
and you still
that
remember
do you
that.
Want to sing that for us, Jeremy?
No, hopefully there are no tapes of that. Let's talk, Joanne, about when we first got paper money in the United States. When did that happen?
Right. Well, so the Civil War era really marked the start of U.S. government-issued paper currency, both for the U.S. government in the North and the Confederacy in the South. Now, both North and South, they didn't really have the gold and silver necessary to wage a war, which was obviously really expensive. So in both cases, both governments turned to paper money to fund the war effort. Now, in the North, these were called greenbacks. Supposedly, as I said, backed by precious metals. But in reality, more than anything else, kind of like I suggested before, more than anything else, the value of these currencies was based on confidence in the future of the governments that were issuing them. Now, the important thing to note about paper currency in the North and the South, of course, is that in the North, the Union was using greenbacks as legal tender. It was official currency. And so it was regulated in some way, whereas in the South, paper currency was being produced by individual states. It wasn't really regulated. There was amazing inflation, and it really ended up hurting both the Southern economy and morale.
Now, during the Great Depression, Franklin Delano Roosevelt took the U.S. off the gold standard. Why?
Well, the most proximate reason was what Great Britain did. They went off the gold standard, and that really shattered confidence, exactly the point that Joanne was talking about. It shattered confidence in currencies that were backed by gold. And for the United States to continue to redeem its dollars in gold meant that everybody who was now worried that they weren't going to get paid in dollars that were worth anything, started going to the U.S. Treasury to say, give me my gold. So Roosevelt was really forced to take the country off the gold standard, although he only did it for U.S. citizens. He didn't do it vis-a-vis other countries. Other countries could still go to the U.S. Treasury and redeem their dollars in gold. He didn't want to undermine the entire international trading system, but he did want to stop the run on the banks in the United States. He also did something that was very important for future monetary policy. He wanted to have some control over just how much that dollar was worth. And he knew that if he went off the gold standard, it would not be worth as much. And he wanted that. He wanted to reinflate the currency, because the major problem with the currency during the Great Depression was deflation. There was no demand. He wanted to stimulate that demand by putting more dollars, even if they weren't really worth as much, in people's pockets so that they could buy things and get that economy going again.
And by doing that, by taking the U.S. off of the gold standard, he ushered in the current system of fiat money. This is basically just paper money. But explain how this works. Why does a dollar in my wallet have value, but a piece of monopoly money does not?
Well, fiat money, like other currencies, depends on trust. But in the case of fiat money, you are trusting the entity that is issuing that money. And just to be bipartisan, Richard Nixon in the early 1970s finished the job. He stopped redeeming dollars for gold
for anybody,
for foreign countries, for anybody. And that really did create a fiat currency, meaning that the dollar was not backed by any kind of precious metal for anybody.
Well, and when you talk about confidence, that sort of brings us to where we are today, which is the rise of Bitcoin, the rise of other cryptocurrencies, and now the possible rise of Libra, the Facebook cryptocurrency. Is this about people not trusting the government with their money?
It's about not trusting the government. But here's what we do trust. We do trust a technology called blockchain technology that in essence distributes the record of everything you do on these cryptocurrencies to thousands of different partners, meaning computers. So you would have to fool a whole bunch of people independently in order to rig the Bitcoin system. At least that's what Bitcoin thinks.
And, you know, what Brian just said there brings us right back to the Libra currency, which, you know, like every other form of currency, what happens to it is going to depend on the confidence that people have in it as a form of currency. And that's going to boil down to what kind of confidence people have in Facebook.
Which, as we know, is astronomical right now, given the privacy scandals and everything else. Everyone has full confidence in Facebook's ability.
Well, see, Jeremy, this is the deepest irony of all. Who would you trust to be like totally hands off and not try to rig the system at all? I mean, the whole thing about cryptocurrencies is that nobody is in control. It's distributed. Do you think someone's in control at Facebook? Do you think it's like a gigantic corporation? I think so. It's almost the opposite of the ideal behind the original idea for a cryptocurrency, which is a kind of techno-libertarian, we don't need organization, we don't need bureaucracy, we definitely don't need government. We can just distribute all this information. It, in essence, checks itself. Doesn't sound like Facebook to me.
Well, let's see what happens with Libra. Brian Ballow and Joanne Freeman, historians and co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks for
having
me. Thank
you, Jeremy.
Summer is here, and so a familiar sight returns to the night sky, bats. They help farmers and the rest of us by eating about a million bugs a year per bat. But white nose syndrome has severely reduced the bat population. In Pennsylvania, the disease has pushed some species to the statewide endangered species list. As Reed Frazier of the Allegheny Front reports, scientists are testing a new method to try to save them.
On a bright morning in central Pennsylvania, about 20 people in white Tyvek suits gather around Greg Turner, a biologist with the Pennsylvania Game Commission.
Then we're going to continue moving through the site till we get to about the middle. And the middle is where the little brown should be on the ceiling up at the top. And we're going to grab 20 little brown bats for the study. When we grab those bats...
The team is here at an abandoned railroad tunnel to check on a population of little brown bats. The species has been hit hard by white nose syndrome, a decade-old plague on America's bat population. This team is looking at whether a commonly used chemical can slow the epidemic. Wading into the tunnel in ankle-deep water, they eventually get to higher ground. It's pitch black, aside from headlamps and flashlights, which reveal tiny bats hibernating inside crevices in the tunnel walls.
So that's a little brown bat right there. And it has a little bit of a dark mask across the face there.
Scientists are trying lots of things to help these bats. Some are working on vaccines or using UV light to treat bats. This group is trying something else. Last summer, they treated this tunnel with a common antifungal agent. Today, they're trying to see if it helped reduce the spread of the invasive fungus that causes white nose syndrome. Turner carries a ladder into the tunnel and opens it beneath a clump of hibernating bats. He climbs up with a harvesting pole, a long, thin rod with a piece of fabric wrapped around the end. He nudges the bats with the fabric tip until they grab on with their claws. He then lowers them onto a net held by the team below. While Turner is up on the ladder, his colleague Barry Overton from nearby Lock Haven University explains the chemical they used here to treat the tunnel, polyethylene glycol, is found in toothpaste and laxatives. The treatment, he says, is just like spraying a field with insecticide.
But we're not treating the bats. We're trying to lower the environmental reservoir of the pathogen.
Overton says they wouldn't treat naturally formed caves because they wouldn't want to disturb their delicate microbiomes formed over millennia. But tunnels like this one, built within the last 100 years, could be fair game.
There's plenty of abandoned mines and plenty of railroad tunnels in Pennsylvania that could be refugia that we could treat that could help get the population of bats up.
After capturing the bats, the team members put them, still half asleep, in small paper bags. Gradually, they begin to stir, scratching at the bags with their claws. Marianne Gagnon, a PhD candidate at Temple University, is weighing and measuring each bat.
The ones we had this morning were all between 6 and a bit above 10 grams.
That's the weight of 2 pennies. She tells me to pick up one of the paper bags to see how light they are.
It doesn't.
And that's a big brown, so it's bigger.
I don't feel like I'm holding anything.
Oh, it's really light.
There's nothing in the bag.
After the team weighs and measures each bat, they swab their wings to test for the DNA of the fungus that causes white nose. It came from Europe or Asia around 2006, says one of the team's leaders, Brent Sewell, a biologist with Temple University. He says little brown bats were once common in Pennsylvania, but because of white nose, it's now on the statewide endangered species list and might be on the federal list soon.
We are just seeing massive declines, whereas you might have seen tens of thousands of bats previously. You might go to the same exact site today and only see tens of bats.
Turner and Sewell photograph each bat using UV light. If there's any white nose fungus on the wing, it will glow orange. Some of the wings have orange splotches on them, signs of white nose. But overall, Turner says these bats look like they're doing well.
The vast majority of them seem to have less infection, kind of a rate, I'd put it equivalent to like mid-season. So they probably did have a slight delay on getting exposed, which is what we were kind of going for.
He holds one of the last bats by its wing and lets it hang until it starts flapping on its own.
Come on, fly. There you go.
They need a little encouragement sometimes.
The bat takes off down the dark tunnel. If all goes well, it will leave the cave in a few weeks, safe from white nose for another summer. Turner says he hopes to release his findings by the end of the year. For Here and Now, I'm Reed Frazier.
And this program note to close out the hour, we have been closely following the rising tensions between the U.S. and Iran. This afternoon on All Things Considered, a look at the role the country of Oman plays in trying to bridge relations between the two countries. That's today on ATC. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.